This band is rocking.
They are totally rocking.
My goodness.
You recognize them?
Well, it sounds like the Sonics to me.
Yeah, it's same idea. Band from... we played them here. So, do you remember I played the Monkees cover of them? This band did the Mummies.
Oh, the Mummies.
The Mummies, remember that lo-fi?
And they're all dressed like mummies on the hood of a car. Right. Yeah, there they are.
The Mummies. Their album, Never Been Caught. And in the UK, it's called Fuck CDs. It's the Mummies. They don't put out CDs. They only put out vinyl. So you got to love them for that, right?
Oh, my God.
There's a little number called Skinny Ninny.
Ah, yes. What year is this?
This 2018, Ryan. This record, though, was released in 1992.
Yes, that's what I was driving at.
Yeah, I didn't either. It's great. It's great, though.
Smart, Alec.
You, Weisenheimer. But this, the great thing, every one of their records, which I think was only two, they put out, they always wrote fuck CDs on it somewhere. And way down at the bottom, it's great. I mentioned on the episode, I can't remember the episode they were played on because this is a random pick by Liz at the beginning of every show, of course. And at the bottom, they wrote, if you like this album at all, get the debut Supercharger album. It fucking rules over this crap.
I love it.
So essentially they're telling you to go buy their competitor's record.
Yeah,
that theirs
friends.
Is shit. And yeah, it's wonderful. I love that.
Other
the Mummies.
Better.
It's a great record, man. Lo-fi as fuck, man.
All right, well, let's get cracking here.
Crack is spectacular.
Release the Kraken.
Hi, this is Clem Burt from Blondie. You're listening to the Shabby Road Record Show. Rock on.
Well, hey, Labba! The Shabby Road Record Show is on the air, your hipster-free vinyl podcast. I'm your host, Ryan McKay, and now, he told you once, you son of a bitch, he's the best it's ever been. That's A.D. Adams.
Well, you know it, gunslinger. Hello once again from sunny but still real shitty Sunny Slope, Arizona, the place where hookers are free to hook, panhandlers are encouraged to handle pans, and bum piss incense is sold at the local Slope Mart. God, I love this place, and by love I mean hate. But we're all safely locked within the plush and opulent confines of the world's shittiest studio and ready to spin some glorious vinyl for you good folks listening all over the world. So strap in. Strap on. Here comes episode 173 of the little disaster we like to call the Shabby Road Record Show. Let's do this, Ryan. I got records.
Yes, indeed, AD. That's a great idea. We do have some fantastic vinyl records to share with you tonight. It is 173, as AD mentioned, episode 173. So that means each of us have brought one from 1973, mm-hmm. along with two other knuckleheads alongside it. So six records in total. And let's say hi to our good friend over there in the Shabby Command Center. That is Liz Morgan. What's up, Liz Morgan?
Hello.
Oh, she gets a snap.
The jazz snap, yes.
Yes. Hey, let's give a shout-out to our friends over at NameOnAnything.com, AD.
NameOnAnything.com. That's right, Ryan. NameOnAnything.com. If you want your name, a favorite photo, a business logo, or whatever, well, on anything, then get a hold of our pals at NameOnAnything.com and put it on fucking anything. You want your band's logo on a box of Wheaties? Done. You want that embarrassing nude photo of your grandmother on a t-shirt just in time for the big family reunion? No problemo, amigo. How about your company name on generic beer cans for the industry convention coming up, showing that you are luscious and not worthy of doing business with? Well, who can do that for you? I have no fucking idea. Nah, just kidding. Good folks at NameOnAnything.com. They'll put your name on whatever you want. And like our pal Mr. T says, I pity the fool that don't get this shit at NameOnAnything.com.
Oh, for God's sake.
Now, in Espanol, Señor T, nombre en cualquier punto con.
Oh, come on. Wow. Oh, God. Sorry, you derailed me. Save 10%. Seriously, save 10% if you go over to NameOnAnything.com and you mention Shabby Road Record Show is the ones where you heard of that great website and those great people over there. Yeah, all right. Let's get some records out. Let's stop. We fooled around long enough.
And fell in love.
Fooled around and did a live read. Liz has the two playing cards, a red card and black card. AD's red on black. And we're going to see. She's got one in each hand. You got them?
Yeah, there's three up there, too. I put Mark's Sid Vicious card up there as well.
I don't think we need that.
No. But
there's only
just
two
for,
of us.
Just for guests, though. Okay. That way we got a third card.
I'll go with the right hand, Liz. Tell me which one is in your right hand.
Black.
Hey, I chose myself.
You did.
I got a shabby classic here. I mean, when you talk about Shabby Road and what were some of the bands that we really like and that seem to come up on the show often, this is definitely one of those bands, somewhat underground, popular in the Northeast, but probably not well known across the rest of the planet, rest of the U.S. and the rest of the planet.
Northeast.
They haven't been on the show for like a year. This will probably make their fifth appearance. But the record I have is a record of theirs that has not been has not found its way into a mystery box as of yet. I brought our friends, not really our friends, but one of our favorite bands, Stars.
Oh,
and
hey,
I got
now.
Attention Shoppers.
Well, sure you do.
Attention right. Shoppers, which is Stars' third album.
And a good one.
STARZ
yes.
is how that is spelled. Kiss fans, if you've not listened to Stars, well, what's wrong with you? You need to listen to Stars.
Right? To take a look at Joe X Doobie's stash, if nothing else.
Right, no kidding, right? So the thing about Stars is there's a Kiss connection here. That's why I mentioned Kiss fans, because Bill O'Coin and Rocksteady, they managed Stars as well. And not as well, because right around the time they're hooking up with Stars, Kiss is taking off like a rocket ship to Saturn.
Bad timing for the Stars guys.
Yeah, yeah. So this is Attention Shoppers. That's the name of the record. And it comes out January 1978.
That's cool.
Their first two albums were produced by Jack Douglas. And then they decided to go their own way and produce this themselves. So you mentioned Joe X Doobie. He's a shabby favorite, right?
He's
the drummer.
He is.
And Joe X Doobie was someone that Richie Rano, who is the guitarist of Stars, had seen, and I don't know this story, I just saw this sentence, and I'm putting it in my notes. Joe Doobie was someone that Rano had seen failing spectacularly in a televised weightlifting competition.
What?
I don't know. I don't have any further information. But why was Joe X Doobie, who has the greatest mustache in rock and roll?
Absolutely. Think Raleigh Fingers, with long hair.
Got the oil out,
right,
and
yeah.
we're doing like, yeah.
The handlebar, if you will,
handlebar,
right?
Yes. So, yeah, so Richie goes on to say by 1978, 79, they were so disheartened by the label and their management, especially the label, because they had a good run. They got on these great tours, Kiss, of course, being one of them. But they would just rock, and they had, you know, a charismatic lead singer in Michael Lee Smith, who was the older brother of heartthrob Rex Smith, who I'm sure Liz is familiar with.
Yes.
Wow. You okay over this?
Rex is his middle name. First name being Heartthrob.
Heartthrob Rex Smith.
Heartthrob Smith.
So they're just kind of, they're watching Capitol Records drop the ball on all this stuff. They're not giving them the push. They're not giving them the attention. Maybe they don't have the rock and roll arm of their company. Because that's the thing. You need radio guys. You need all these people that are connected. And even a large label like Capitol maybe just wasn't there to push them over the top.
Wasn't their bag at the time. Capitol wasn't pushing a lot of hard rock bands in
Yeah, they
79.
May not have been. I'm not really sure if they had a lot of rock bands on their roster by this point.
Early in the 70s, they stopped in and got some Casablanca's Coke. I mean, a deal yes. with Casablanca is what I meant.
So they were so pissed off, and this is Richie Rano, guitarist, saying, quote, "We were so pissed off, the roadies were told to throw out any Capitol Records people from backstage at the concerts." So
wow.
they banned Capitol Records representatives from being at the show. Like, "Hey, guys, I'm here from Capitol Records and going to check out the show."
You know,
get the fuck out of here, you
I mean,
suits.
I kind of get that, but at the same time, that doesn't bode well for when they're shopping for their next deal.
No.
I'm guessing.
No.
Because it's not like these A&R guys who's with Capitol now won't be with Arista 2 weeks from now.
Right.
And, or Buddha, you know, or whoever, pick a label, any label, Atlantic, you know, in 6 months from now.
And they're a middling rock act. I mean, they're not really burning up the charts. They have, like I said, they're kind of a regional thing where it's Northeast is where
yeah,
they're from,
yeah.
the New York area and that. So, but it just didn't really, never really took off.
No, they had that national exposure on Don Kirshner's rock concert one night.
Was that when they were, was that the first album?
First album era, yeah. And they played Pull the Plug and they, Jesus, a Fallen Angel.
Oh, yeah.
Their single.
Yeah.
You know?
Good record. I mean, all these Stars records are great.
Oh, they absolutely do.
Yeah. There's this, the self-titled debut, which is 76? Five or six?
Yeah.
And then Violation followed that. And Violation contains their hit Cherry Baby, which, I mean, hit. It was like barely top 40.
Right.
And that was their really, that was it. That was the end
and
of it.
I'm really partial to their first record. I think that's a strong album. Every track on it, man.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
They all are. They're, yeah. Okay, not 100%, but
it gets
90%.
Yeah. They move swiftly into some serious power pop, AOR power pop.
You need a single, guys.
Yes, and that's what they're doing on Violation. And they achieved it with Cherry Baby. And this album follows that trend, especially on side one. But side two is a little more adventurous, has some different approach. What I'm going to play is side two, track one, X-Ray Specs, which sounds like Cheap Trick doing their sort of punkier side.
Okay.
When there's Liz.
Oh.
Liz's trigger word is punk. Punky.
Punky.
Yeah, he's not in this band. That's a different Kiss connected band, Angel. So this sounds like, you know, when Cheap Trick does like He's a Whore or one of those kind of songs from the first album.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
Just sort of
punky stuff.
Yeah. It got a weird little time signature thing. I don't know if it's just they drop a beat or something. There's some really jagged rhythm in this song from the Dubster, Joe X Dubey.
He was a beat off.
He was a beat off.
Was he? Really?
But thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So with side one, it's got songs like She and That Ilk on side one. It's a great power pop album. On that end of things, you know, you got the obligatory ballad, but side two is a little more of a rocker. And so, you know, I would certainly encourage anybody who's never listened to Stars, find one of those records, hopefully the first self-titled one, and just start there, or Violation, or this one, and Coliseum Rock is the fourth one. And that was pretty much it, although they, you know, in the 90s, they put some record out or something.
What label is Coliseum Rock on? That's not on Capitol, is it? Or is it?
I think it's the last on. Yeah, it's the last one on Capitol.
Okay, I thought they did three and out, and then had to find another deal for their last.
No, I think that was the end. They had a four record. Bill Coyne signed.
So probably picked up the option on this one.
Yeah, and that whole thing came from, you know, Bill Coyne, his guy, Sean Delaney, knew the bass player from Stars, and that's how they connected those dots together. So
imagine.
Sean's like, you got to check out this band Stars, and Bill Coyne's like, yeah, I love them, they're great, let's get them a deal with Capitol.
I'm guessing with Kiss's popularity rising, their star rising with the Coyne thing too, that helped to leverage.
Oh, sure.
Like, you know, I guarantee it was probably a three album deal with an option for these guys. That's why I asked about that fourth album.
At that
point in time, that's probably why they stacked the first side with the pop songs. They're like, all right, fuckers.
Yeah.
Because your third one, and a coin's going, you need to get a hit off this record, or I'm going to have to really go in and fight for that fourth record for you. Don't make me do it.
And I'm not really in the mood for that. Right. I don't need to do that, because Kiss is making me bazillions of dollars in 1978.
I used to love you guys a lot more when I didn't have to work so hard for you.
So let's drop the needle on this. Side 2, track 180, X-Ray Specs, a good, cool, punky number, Liz. Attention shoppers. It's January 1978, and we're going to the New York area and listening to some Stars. He can see right through you, baby.
While the dog is choking on a chicken bone, it sounds like.
Hey, come on. It was 1978. They didn't have the cool production tools there.
Cat was choking up a hairball. Yes.
So what'd you think?
I liked it. It's a great album. And I don't have this album. The only Stars album I don't have. I thought I had them all, but apparently I don't.
Yep. You can find it for $3 anywhere.
I'll be looking for it.
Attention
Shoppers. It's on my list now, yeah.
All right, AD, what you got?
Hey, oh,
yes.
Ryan.
Yes.
Kiss my entire ass.
Oh, did I forget to introduce Sally?
What would you do with a brain if you had one?
Okay, Sally. That's... Liz has brought with her Sal 5000, of course, and I have just ignored her. Oh, no.
Shit
and
list.
Now,
here we go, man. You've ruined it for everybody now.
We're going to hear a lot.
She pissed her off.
We're going to hear a lot from her.
You bet your ass with her.
Sorry, Sally. I hope we can be friends still. Somehow.
I would tell you to kiss my ass, too, but you probably can't find it, you blind motherfucker.
I earned that.
You did. I'm behind you all the way.
Let's change the subject, AD. What'd you bring?
Let's do that. I brought some vinyl.
Good. Yay, vinyl. Yay.
This band first appeared on the Shabby Road Records show on episode number 42. This is only the second time this band has been played.
Oh.
The episode title was, ironically enough, per our discussion during the while the record was playing, the title of the episode was "So Who's Gonna Do the A&R Guy?"
We were talking off
pretty
mic
weird
about some of the relationships that were mentioned in my Stars segment. Yes.
Yes. Anyway, I brought me a little Tucky Buzzard.
Tucky Buzzard has returned.
Wow. I've been finding their records, Ryan, and this one's a doozy.
Okay, Tucky Buzzard.
Check that out, Tucky Buzzard. Right. So this dude, okay, so here's the deal. This is, I played them once before, and this band, it's hard enough to find any information on this band. So any information that's out there, primarily, I used it in the first episode.
Well, what was it? Do you remember what it was? Like some of the beats?
Well, yeah, I mean, just kind of where they're from and all that stuff. I mean, they kind of formed in they were a larger band, like a five-piece band kind of with horns and, you know, that late 60s thing. And then what they did in 69, they trimmed it down. They basically take the five core members, guitar, bass, drums, and keyboard and singer, and got rid of the horns, per se, as part of the band, and then just sort of basically remove the horns and become a rock band.
Okay.
So that remained intact. They were called The End in the 60s, and they changed their name to Tucky Buzzard and, got to work on their first record right away. They lost their drummer. Now, this is kind of screwy, but this record business shit. They lost their drummer during the recording of their first album, who'd been with them, you know, the whole time.
Well, did he get locked in the basement, or they just couldn't find him?
They just lost him. Yeah,
oops.
I thought you had him. Well, gave him to you.
You were supposed to watch him this week.
He's hard to keep an eye on, that one.
There he goes over there.
Oh, fuck, he's flash. So they replaced him, and he basically recorded most of the album, at least half the album, but he didn't get any credits on the record. The new guy got all of them, the guy, Paul Francis.
And that's their first album.
Oh, I'm sorry. The new guy was Chris Johnson. Yeah, Paul Francis was sort of the Pete Best guy. They left him completely out of the credits. But if you notice, they on the credits on the back, along the bottom right, they credit the guy who got him cigarettes and beer. But they wouldn't credit the drummer who played. So it's pretty interesting, you know? I'm like, you guys, come on with that.
I wonder what went down with that.
Credit where credit's due. I'm a big fan of that. I don't, you know, if you got a ringer on your album and you know, want to put the drummer's, your regular drummer's photo on the front, great. You want to list him as a drummer, great. But somewhere on the album, put the guy who played on it.
Right.
Just somewhere. Just do that, for fuck's sake.
Yeah, we ran into that with Live Evil and Vinny Appice.
Yeah.
Like listed way low.
You know, it's rampant in the business. Ringers. Matter of fact, I did a record recently.
You did?
I did. A punk album.
And you're a ringer on it?
You betcha.
Ooh, and you're not at liberty to say?
You know what it is.
I do?
U.S. Bombs?
No, I don't know about this.
I just did a 4-track EP.
Oh, good for you.
For a band called the U.S. Bombs. And it's basically ringer work.
Nice.
Yeah. Oops.
The Dick Wagner of Phoenix.
Cat's out of the bag. I guess I spoiled that, didn't I?
Yeah.
I already got paid, though. Fuck it.
You're not a ringer anymore.
Yeah, they paid me cash.
on the nail.
Right, yeah. So anyway, you know, Bill Wyman, now Rolling Stones bass player, was a friend of lead vocalist Jimi Henderson. And he's like, well, you know, I'll produce you guys. So he, and along with Glenn Johns, who did a lot of the Rolling Stones stuff, they said, well, we'll produce you guys. So the Tucky Buzzard records are great sounding records. Now, what is Tucky Buzzard? What's their deal? Well, they're kind of, well, it's such a cliche term, a bluesy hard rock British band. Okay. So,
yeah, there's a lot of those.
Okay, should we talk about Savoy Brown?
Wishbone Ash.
Status Quo, who's got, you know, that's, again, those are different styles, but they still kind of fall under that same kind. You could even say early pre-Dudes Mott the Hoople.
Cactus.
Right, so that genre. And a lot of people kind of, if you were to... You know, on a color scale, like glam being red and pink and, you know, and blues being, well, blue, you know, this
makes
is
sense.
A lot of people kind of put, you know, this kind of in sort of brown, gray, you know, British blues. Yeah, it's not blues, really. It's not rock, really. So it's mundane to a lot of people.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, I say that because when I was young, which is a long fucking time ago.
No, covered wagon.
Jesus,
times.
Yeah, man. Yeah, we're down by the Brazos River. You know, we're having a fish fry. Yeah, right. A gold. I saw gold. But so I fell into that category. I was just like, Savoy Brown. I don't want to hear, you know, sort of electric skiffle music. I don't want to hear another harmonica solo. I don't want to hear a booty slide. Now I've fallen in love with that style. I mean, you know, I can't get my hands on enough of the Wishbone Ash records. I can't find enough of the Status Quo records, you know?
Yeah.
Got all the Mott stuff, but, you know, but that kind of stuff. So, you know, I mean, it ranges from the blues to the hard rock. Some of it borderline prog. Some of it borderline pop when you start getting into, the, you know, the Status Quo stuff, right?
Yeah.
And, but every once in a while you got that raucous boogie woogie number.
Yeah.
You know, which I'm a big fan of. I'm going to play that off this record. They got one closes the album that it's just a great boogie number. It's we'll get that in a second.
So 1-4-5 boogie, or is there something a little more?
It's really cool. It's called The Last War. It's called It's called Last War. And it's got a cool riff. I love the way it riffs out. It's got a kind of a bluesy. Yeah, I wouldn't say 1-4-5, but yeah, probably a 1-5-4. It's the same damn chords.
Okay,
5-4-1.
Big difference.
One.
Yeah.
But it's got this really that boom kataka doom kata, and then the bougie down dirty feel. The guitars are real gritty, but the riff is cool because it's not in six and it's not in eight. It's a measure of six then eight. So it's not it's not a bluesy 12-8, and it's not a, you know, bouncing 4-4. So it's the main riff is a six count, then an eight count, which is kind of cool.
Wow, that is
weird. It's interesting. And it's not, you know, a complex number. The words are pretty
pedestrian.
You know, yeah, you know, it's like the last war. It's him and his chick, you know, and all this stuff. And you're comparing it to that, to war and stuff like that. And but later in the song, it's just weird. They do this weird thing. They're just doing kataka, doing kataka, doing kataka, doing kataka. They just speed it up.
Okay. Wow.
Like just blatantly, and you're going, oh, all right. Okay.
Where are we going here?
And then
we're,
you want it
off
to kind of hang. It's like, all right, yeah. And then the drummer just blows up, like literally explodes.
Maybe that's why he's not credited on the album. He literally exploded into a globule.
I'm not sure what you're right. Yeah, that's what happened to him. But I don't know. I don't know. It's sort of a solo, but it's not really. You know,
yes, sir.
But this band was quite prolific. You know, their entire lifespan was only 5 years, 69 through 74. But they released their first album in 71 and their last album in 73. So they put five studio albums out between 71 and 73. They put two out in 71, one out in 72, and two out in 73.
Wow.
So this is the one I brought, was the first of the 73 releases called All Right on the Night. And it's, dude, this is a great freaking record, man. But now let's talk about, I want to put a new word, Ryan, into the dictionary here at Shabby Road.
Shabby Road lexicon.
Yes. Now, Ryan, if you could describe the back of that album. What's the name of the band first?
Tucky Buzzard.
What Buzzard?
Tucky.
Tucky Buzzard. And what's the guy on the back of the record doing, Ryan?
He is chugging a beer.
He is tuckying a beer, Ryan.
Oh, like Lynn Tucky,
like
from the
Len
Susie Tucky. Cottrell.
So they're both tuckying, apparently, because look, Len Tucky.
And Tucky.
Tucky Buzzard. And they're chugging. Okay, so that is a new word.
A brown bottle of beer. Yeah,
so,
long neck.
All right, mate, let's go down to the pub and tucky us some ale.
All
right? I tuckied that whole fucking thing. Right?
I think we could add that to the lexicon.
I think so. Ironically enough, both these records, I'm not sure who tuckied first, but they both were put out in 73. So maybe we'll have to have a tucky off.
And somehow became English.
Right? Yeah. Well, Susie somehow became English by
right,
moving
yeah. So
there.
Susie Quattro album cover, Lynn Tucky chugging a beer, back cover of Tucky Buzzard's album. What's the name of this album?
All Right for the Night.
Chugging a beer in a similar fashion.
Or All Right on the Night, I'm sorry.
All Right on the Night, yeah.
So yeah, man. So let's spin a little bit of Tucky Buzzard from their fourth album, 1973. A song called "Last War" from the album "All Right on the Night." And this song is written by Terry Taylor and Jimmy Henderson, the guitar player and the singer. And yeah, man. Let's Tucky a brew.
Thank you.
What's that?
Tucky Buzzard.
What the fuck was that drummer doing? He's going ape shit.
What was the whole, like, what happened, right? And it happened for a while.
It did.
Wait, the first thing, I mean, the song is a great song, right? It's a great boogie-woogie number.
I loved it. And it's Sabbath. It was like Sabbath-y.
It's very Sabbath-y, right, you know, and it's got that grit. Like I was saying earlier, it goes from hard rock to boogie-woogie. I mean, this is a great, great record. It really represents the best styles of all those bands we mentioned earlier
Love the singer's voice, love the guitar playing. Yeah,
it's great.
The drummer was
But, you know, the first thing, though, when they first jumped the tempo up, though, right?
Yeah, you're going, okay.
But they jumped that tempo up, and there's a guitar solo going on. And somebody was asleep at the helm, because, like, they cranked the tempo up, and all you hear is ka-chang, ka-ching, ka-chang, ka-ching,
ka-chang. They turned the wrong channel up.
Yeah, the rhythm guitar was blasting, and the guitar player was working his balls off. Hey, I'm working back here. Well,
Bill Wyman fell asleep at the controls.
Bill, wake up.
You done the solo yet?
Well, we've missed it, but let's move on.
All right. And then the drummer thing.
I don't know what that
What's that guy doing?
It was a hurricane. A hurricane of drums.
The first time I heard it, I'm going, oh, this is the monster fill, but it's frenetic. And I'm going, I can't keep, there's no time. It's like.
No, it's just madness.
What's going on? And then he just never comes out of it.
No, I never. He seized up.
I think you were actually wiping tears out of your eyes while
I was losing it. That was fucking funny.
That's the way you end the fucking song. That's called Last War. That's on Purple Records, by the way. The great Tucky Buzzard. And I'm going to Tucky this 805, Ryan.
Hey, Tucky that thing. Come on. Let me see. There he goes. Yeah, there you go. Oh, wow.
Oh, Lord.
Almost threw up on me, Mike.
Oh, Jesus.
I don't think that sound has ever come out of me, ever. And there have been a lot of weird sounds coming out of me.
It's usually the last sound
at least right before I fall asleep.
Yeah. All right, let's get it together.
Right?
Let's reel it in. It in here. I got something from the Seaborg Record Club.
Oh, those always are good ones.
Our good pal Steven Seaborg sends us a record each and every month. And this month, he's just outdone himself. I am in freaking love with this album. He said, Ryan, I know it's your turn to get the record this month, and I've got a prog record from 1973. And I said, I'm in.
Oh, gosh, yes.
I'm in. And so this little puppy arrives at my doorstep, and I take her on inside, and I open it up. And I don't know what it's going to be, but I open it up, and I see it. It's this band called Nectar.
Oh, yeah.
Nectar, and the album is Remember the Future.
I've got two.
Do you have some Nectar?
Yeah, I do, from the Mott collection. I don't have this one, though.
This is the one, according to Steve, and he's right. I've listened to some of the other ones. For some reason, I told Steve this. I said, you know, I feel like I've heard Nectar before, and I didn't like them, but I must have been totally confused, because this record, when I put it on, I was just taken. I was swept away, AD.
Wow.
I was swept away. It's so great. It's a concept album, two sidelong epics that are sort of broken up into little songs, but it's a continuous, as prog albums are oft to do. They just kind of continue on.
Oh, you betcha.
But it's a guitar, bass, drums, and B3.
Yeah.
And I think the guitar player is the guy that sings. And it's just great. The great guitar player. And the drummer's great. Everything about it. It's recorded well. I just loved it.
That's cool. I think, like I said, I think two came in the Mott collection. And they were good, but notice I haven't chambered them yet. I haven't put them on yet. They were good.
Can find them while this record plays, I'd like to see which ones you have. Because I kind of did these days, Netflix, you binge watch Breaking Bad or you binge watch.
Right.
So I went on Spotify and I binged Nectar albums until I couldn't take it anymore, until I got to around 1976 or
7. Oh, wow.
And this, of course, is my one pick from 73. This is episode 173, right. So I got my 173. And it's this one, Remember the Future from Nectar.
Now, so, Nectar,
N-E-K-T-A-R. Which is how it is spelled in Germany. And that's where
they lived, not where they're from. They're a bunch of Englishmen who, for whatever reason, I dug a little bit. I couldn't find out what the reason why they wound up in Hamburg, Germany in 1969. That's when the band formed.
Well, a lot of bands did that. It was right across the channel.
Yeah, and maybe that's what
and,
it is, yeah.
You know, it was the closest port city to if you were coming out of London.
Okay.
In southeast part of England.
The Beatles were over there and stuff, and maybe that's what they're doing.
It was a port city, a lot of gigs there for English bands. It was a mecca for English bands and probably just ended up staying.
Yeah, I think that's what they did. So the Englishmen are Roy Albrighton on guitar and vocals. Tremendous guitar player. Love this guy. Alan Taff Freeman on keyboards. Derek Moore on bass. And Ron Howden on drums. And Mick Brockett and Keith Walters on lights and special effects.
Good for them. See, they gave credit.
They gave credit. Apparently, they did a fairly interesting art and light exhibition during Nectar's performances. And as I binged my way through Nectar's discography, the first album comes out around 70, I think. And it's really out there, kind of progressive. Journey to the Center of the Eye, which is about an astronaut, you know, and it's this cool, real psychedelic and pretty rough around their edges in terms of production, but still all the elements are there in terms of the musicianship and stuff. And then they move the ball forward considerably on the next album, A Tab in the Ocean. And that one, again, a similar kind of approach, you know, lots of sort of prog elements, but a little more accessible, you know. And then this is their third album, Remember the Future. And they're starting to get a little groundswell of attention in England, in Europe. But for some reason, Remember the Future, this third album in 1973, does really well in the States. So they become fairly popular in the States. This album cracks the top 40.
And what?
And they're headlining shows all across America.
I had no, who knew?
Yeah, it was very strange. And they're just like,
wow,
we were surprised as anybody. Like, we're nobodies. And all of a sudden, they're huge in America.
Hey, like, not in America, huge, but you're going to do okay, though.
Yeah. And everybody thinks they're German because of the spelling of Nectar, which is with a K, N-E-K-T-A-R. But he's like, they're all Englishmen. So they go back to Europe, and then they tour with Frank Zappa. And they have a really successful tour there. And that starts to break them a little bit in Europe. And I did see an interview with Roy, the guitarist, and he was saying that every night, you know, we'd travel all across Europe and we'd be playing in Spain, you'd play in Italy, you'd play in Germany or whatever. And every night Frank Zappa would play the respective country's national anthem in some shape or form. He'd get a hold of it and like Zappa-ize it.
Wow.
He did that every night. And Roy was really taken with, I mean, he was blown away. He'd just sit in the wings of the stage and watch Zappa just be freaking.
You can imagine that?
Wow. Yeah.
Look, I'm such a huge Zappa fan.
I know, yeah. It's really cool. So this is a concept album, as I mentioned before. It's about a blind boy who is communicating with a winged, blue-skinned, extraterrestrial
Pope. Oh, sorry.
Named Bluebird. Now the thing about Bluebird is that he is rejected by other humans in the world because he's a blue skinned winged extraterrestrial. So they're having a hard time, you know, dealing.
Hey, who's your weird blue friend over there?
Well, that's, he's an alien actually.
What's with the wings?
He's
you fly,
little,
you fucking listen, fly, you fly.
Little, Joey, he's a little shy about the way he looks. He's trying to fit in.
Wait, he looks, is he cold? He's blue. He's fucking blue.
He's not blue. He's from a different planet.
He's fucking cold.
Joey, keep your voice down. Don't let him hear it. You're upsetting him. Look, he's crying. So
winged.
Winged.
I'm sorry. I hurt your winged friend's feelings.
So he winds up coming across this blind boy who does not see the blue skin and the wingedness of Bluebird. And so he begins to sort of telepathically relate some sort of societal truths with this kid and allows the boy to see through his eyes.
Oh, wow.
And stuff. So that's kind of the gist of the story. A little ambiguous. I mean, you can't really pick that out even by reading the lyrics in there. And it's a... a great looking record, like album art, and it's a gatefold, and it's a really cool looking record. It's just what a great package this album.
You know, it's a cool thing to do. It if you were the writer of this thing, you know, these crazy prog things, you write this completely whacked out. You know, nobody knows what you're talking about, and every interview they go, "So what is it about?" And you just make something up. You're like, "Well, it's about a blue winged guy from another planet," and then you do another one. It's like, "Well, it's about a microorganism from the bottom of my foot that I found in a corn." You know, or what's the album about? Well, it's about it's about animals in Africa and the flies that prey upon
and
them.
It's the same record, yeah, the same lyrics.
Yeah, it's like you can.
I'd be on board with that. That sounds
kind of fun to do.
So I'm going to play the end of side one, movements C and D. Mm. Movement C is titled "Remember the Future," which is the name of the album, and then the final end of side one is movement D, which is called "Confusion," which is a hell of a jam in 5/4 time.
Oh, come on!
Yeah, in 5/4 time, AD. And then what's cool about the end of it, and it'll be a while before we get there, but they come out of 5/4 into straight quarters. And I find myself feeling that it's in three because you start 5/4 feels like a three time, doesn't it? Like, it kind of can.
Well, there's a three in there. It's either going to be subdivided three and two or two and three.
But it certainly feels like a three when you come out. I want to see if you kind of feel that. It's not that. But if just when you first hear it, you're like, oh, then now they're on straight, like a straight quarters on in 3/4. But no, it's 4/4. It just feels like it because you're just coming out of this wild trip in 5/4 where they're just jamming. So, yeah. So look forward to that towards the end of the song. And, gosh, let's try to find where this section starts.
Oh, it's going to run into it.
Yeah. I mean, we're just going to randomly drop the needle in the last 5 minutes of side one. The whole thing is good. Side one and side two, two continuous songs.
Ooh, pretty.
Oh, yes. And the vinyl is colored. Clear. It's orange that matches vinyl. The cover. Yeah, it's just a really cool package. So thank you, Steven Seaborg. Wow, hit a home run in the Seaborg, the SRC, the Seaborg Record Club this month. I am in love with this band, and now I want all of those records, at least the first 4-5 Nectar records I think are worth owning based on my binging habits on Spotify.
See you.
That's Nectar, Remember the Future from 1973, November of 1973, in fact.
That's good prog right there.
Correction, I said, so it was a jam in 5-4, but there may have been a mistake that it was 11-8 first, and then it goes to 5-4.
Yeah, it started off with 5-6, yeah. 5 then 6, right? Yeah. Measure 5, measure 6, and then they drop that sixth beat.
The singer, I just can't put my finger on who he sounds like. You mentioned Peter Gabriel. There's a little bit of that. There's a little bit of...
you were mentioning Moody Blues.
Moody Blues guy, whichever that one guy. Justin Hayward, is it?
I think so, yeah.
But it's still a great, I mean...
It's a good record. Like that.
And you do have it.
We
looked at your collection. Yeah. You do have it.
Well, I had there was two that I had from the Mott collection. I probably put on the wrong one. Usually if like with the Mott collection, some of that stuff, you know, like he had three Josie Cotton albums.
We don't know who that is.
Right. I listened to one of them and I'm like, I'm done with Josie Cotton. She probably has two masterpieces. Right. I picked out the dud, you know? And so when I listened to that Nectar, it was from 77. And the prog in 77 was pretty shitty.
That was...
The early 70s prog was where it was
at. That's a record called Magic is a Child.
Yeah,
should have been your first clue that it may not have been the best.
Right.
But it's a bridge too far in the Nectar catalog. I stop after this album. So you go to 1974's, Down to Earth, which is weird, circus themed.
Step right up.
No, Ricky would like that.
There's an elephant. Yeah, Ricky, he loves his circus music. There's like an elephant song where like it's an elephant dance. It's all instrumental. It's like it's out there, but it's cool though. It's still good. So there you go. That's them. When I talked to Steve Seaborg, who sent that record to us, I called him and I said that I've got a new name for this band. And I call them Yes Bone Ash. They sound like Yes and Wishbone Ash had a baby.
There's a definite rock element. I mean, that's how cool that early...
But what's also cool...
70s prog was, because
also,
it was coming out of the harder psychedelic
yes.
garage. It was sort of married to the psychedelic in the garage with more the avant-garde, and poof, you got your prog.
One other thing I'll mention, too, and remember, they're based in Germany, so there's a krautrock element to what they're exposed to. They toured with... remember that band Birth Control?
Jesus,
they
yeah.
toured with them, and they knew Frumpy, and they probably knew all those bands.
Right.
Like, we love that sort of German scene.
Inga Rumpf,
right?
Oh, man.
Oh, AD. That's the hot song.
She's my Punky Meadows.
All right, Punky. Well, what you got next?
We're going to go down memory lane here, Liz.
Okay.
We are going to go down memory lane. You're going to love this one.
Okay.
Everybody's from Virginia, the Tuyas.
In my box... All right, back in the eight.
You're holding Susie Quattro.
Oh,
he wishes he
you just went
Susie
in my
Quattro.
Box and held up a picture of Susie Quattro.
Look at that.
I know. We all know Susie Quattro.
All right, back in the 1980s on the East Coast, Liz, there was a club, a bunch of clubs actually, that always made Rolling Stones magazine the list of great rock and roll clubs. Right? There was so many, like, East Coast clubs, like the Bayou in Washington, D.C. Every year they would put out the 10 top or the 20 top rock clubs in the U.S. Bayou was always on that list. The Agora Ballroom in Cleveland was on that list all
Hot
the time.
Hot Shots in Quincy, Illinois.
Yeah, no.
Never made the list.
No, Hammer Jacks in Baltimore, right? Hammer Jacks always made it, and then you know, then of course the Whiskey always made it. If you're talking about the West Coast and stuff like that, the Agora had two chains. They had one in Hartford, Connecticut. They had one, in Chicago. But the one in Cleveland was the Agora that everybody knew. I think Alex Harvey did part of the live album there, didn't he?
Probably. He was big in Cleveland.
Yeah, you betcha.
That was it.
But there was also another club that, for a brief moment or two, up in New York.
Yeah.
There were two clubs, actually. One in Brooklyn, one in Queens, and they were called L'Amour's.
Okay.
L'Amour, right?
Okay.
Monarch played there.
L'Amour.
Look who else played there, Ryan.
Okay, you've got some sort of compilation album that...
Side One, Track One. Who's that?
Wrathchild.
Oh, no.
Yes.
You got a Wrathchild.
Listen, back in the day, you'd walk into those fucking bars, and these bars were huge. These were clubs, two stories, balconies. You know, this was when rock and roll was at its peak in the 70s, right? Rock and roll was huge, and the clubs were huge. You'd talk about putting 1,200 people into these clubs and filling them up every night, right?
Louis Rock City.
Yeah, I mean, Louis Rock City. So these clubs were big. They were loud. They were dimly lit, right? Typical of the scene, you know, it was the only decor really, because it was all black. The only decor really was the stage and the posters of the upcoming bands, like half falling off all the walls. That was it. You walked in, and when, you know, back you could smoke in bars, you walk in these places, you know, it just like, just that same stench, that same smell. Like,
I could smell it now.
Stale smell, like mixed with spilled booze, like, you know, a cocktail of every woman's cologne combined, stuck in the carpet.
Women's cologne.
Right, you know, just combine Aquanet, you know, I mean, just that bar, that 80s bar smell. There was nothing like it. And it would get in your clothes.
Thank God for that.
Right? I mean, dude, I got pulled over one time. I swear to God, I got pulled over one time. I had a bunch of road cases in a van, right?
Okay.
I got pulled over, and the cop goes, "Oh, you been drinking?" I'm like, like, no. And I hadn't been, right? I'm like, no. And, you know, you kind of, once that smell permeates your nose, you don't smell it anymore, right? Mm-hmm. And he's like, oh, yeah, you know, get out of the car, right? I went through the road test. I'm going, I haven't been drinking. And I go, dude. I mean, officer, you know, I swear to God, you know what I think it is? I go, I think it's my road cases. He's like, fuck you, you know, whatever.
Fuck you, drummer.
And
I said,
listen, I said, dude, check it out. I kid you not, let me open the thing at the door, side door of the van, open it up. And he put his head in and he goes, oh my God, like, holy shit. You know, like he let me out. And I had not been drinking. And I was like, dude, my road cases smell like a bar.
Like liquor.
It's like fucking horrible. You know, probably somebody spilled a beer on or two or more of them whatever. Yeah. Man. But so that was the time. That was a great time back then, early to mid 80s, right? You know, these clubs, they were loud as hell and they rocked hard. The chicks were half naked, the dudes, everybody was on coke and banging. It was just great.
Oh my God.
And yes, the significant thing
were
about
on coke and banging.
I was half naked.
Oh, half naked. Oh, okay.
But these places, the significant thing about these places is they were the last stop on the way to the big time for bands.
These were the clubs in
any town. Yeah. And, you know, when you're starting to do tours of those, man, that's when you're like, your star is just about to rise.
Yeah.
Or
you're getting
it's your last,
close.
Or you're done. You've gotten that far, but you're not going to go any further.
Yeah.
And so a lot of, and again, if you're on your way down, that was the first stop on the way suicide in a hotel room, you know.
Oh, dear Lord.
But it was an amazing time. It was, you know, and heavy metal was huge. You know, the thrash metal started coming in the mid to late 80s, you know, big giant thrash hair metal. And, you know, me personally, I got really sick of the whole thing. I was just like, so fucking done with it. And, comparatively,
you were there from the 1800s.
I was,
it was over.
Yeah. You know, when they invented the first electricity guitar.
Yeah. You and Tesla working side by side, getting that together.
What would happen if we plugged this into something? Well, there's nothing to plug it into. Let's make something. So, but, you know, so by 87, you know, I had quit playing music for a while. I quit Monarch. I'd been through Dirty Looks and all this stuff. But some young friends of mine.
Mm-hmm.
Were coming up and they were hitting it hard, man. These guys, Wrathchild, were you knew them.
Yeah.
Liz was working in the industry. She was working. You worked with James Turner. You worked at the Foot, right? You worked all kinds.
I don't know what that is.
The Rabbit's Foot. James Turner Productions.
It was a
booking agent, promoter, yeah. Mm-hmm. And there was a guy who worked in there called Chip Seligman, who really was the hard rock guy. When Wrathchild, they started off. In 1978, there was a young band, high school band. Shannon was 15 years old.
Were they called Wrathchild in 1978?
No, they had a bunch of different names.
I think one
of them was Atlantis and a couple other...
Already taken as well.
Names, yeah.
Wrathchild, taken from Iron Maiden, I presume.
Yeah. Okay. The song Wrathchild from
Ultimately
Iron
would become I hope I don't step on your story.
But, no, no.
Wrath Child America is what I know them.
Yeah, there was a UK glam band at the time called Wrath Child.
Also, so, probably took their name from the Iron Maiden.
Yeah,
song
so I would guess
Killers
so. So what they did was that, you know, they kind of each wrote the other a cease and desist, which is kind of cool, like a Mexican standoff. Like, you know, like
you cease and desist first.
Yeah. Well, you cease and desist. I don't know, whatever. So what they both decided was, okay, well then we'll call ourselves Wrath Child America, and the other band called themselves Wrath Child UK.
All right.
So none of them changed their name, but they just added a UK and an America to it. So that was kind of a great way to play it. But these kids, you know, 1978, they put this little band together. You know, it was Terry Carter, Kevin Keller, and Shannon Larkin, a drummer. They were a little band from Martinsburg, West Virginia, you know, which had no circuit. I mean, you know, the Dew Drop In and all that stuff. And so they had that little band they started up with other members, and they needed another guy. And they kept seeing this band in town. What was the name? What was the name of Brad Divin's band's name? I can't remember.
What was the name of Brad Divin's band's name?
So,
we should get transcripts of the show made.
So Brad, they find this guy, Brad Divin's, playing guitar in another band, little local band. And they wanted him. They're like, that guy's got to be in our band, you know? And so they would show up at this band's gigs. And stand like right in the front and just throw business cards at Brad.
He's a singer.
Singer, guitar player.
Oh, okay.
You know, the band's on stage playing, and these three guys are in the front of the stage literally throwing business cards, like throwing another one. Throwing another one.
Really?
Throwing another one.
Wow, that throwing is really out one. In the open. There's no
They're like, we want you in our fucking band, right?
Operation there. It's just like, no, we want you, hey, between songs, yelling, join our band.
That was what they were pretty much doing. So
screw these schlubs behind you.
So he ends up joining the band, right? Yeah. So he's, you know, now they got their scene together. Kevin Keller's playing bass. Brad's playing guitar. Shannon on drums and Terry Carter's in the band. So then... Kevin splits. Brad starts playing bass and lead singing. So now they're a four-piece band. Then they get this guy Jay Abney in, and he starts. So now they got two guitars, bass, drums. They're set.
All right.
Right, like a Metallica lineup, and that they're
or Iron Maiden.
Right, but no frontman.
So their name is Wrath Child.
Well, but no frontman though, like Iron Maiden.
Oh, gotcha.
So it's like you know, like you know, so Brad's the bass player. He's also singing lead.
Ah.
So,
okay.
But then they get the guitar players on each side, you know, Shannon in the back. So these guys were killing it. They looked tough. Shannon was all of, 15 when they started. So by the time they hit the circuit, he's 16, 17 years old. He's a baby, right? Mm-hmm. His long hair down to fucking his tits, you know, and
white and black.
Parted in the middle, yeah, and his one side's black and the other side's white. And he had like five toms and like black, white, black, white, black, white.
Oh, wow.
Two floor toms.
He's already marketing himself or at least branding himself.
Right. Yes. And so, you know, everybody in the scene, Liz, was saying this kid.
Yes.
Not even this band, but this guy's going to be a motherfucker.
Uh-huh.
This guy's got whatever it is. Motherfucker's got it.
And Shannon.
Shannon Larkin, Shannon. Right. So it was interesting. So they got a hold of our... They opened up for us a couple of times. And then they got a hold of our management, our agent, this James Turner Productions. And Chip, who was a new guy on board, Chip Seligman, took them on. And he was the metal guy. He loved metal. And he started managing them as well as booking them. So they really got a really good boost up through Chip. He knew a lot of people and was eager because he was young. He was new in the business. He's as eager and young as you are when you first picked up your guitar and you go, I want to make it playing guitar. Chip was like, I want to be a fucking manager.
Yeah.
That was he really was into it.
Cool. Yeah.
And so he went to bat for them an awful lot and really made things happen. So they put out a couple of records.
45s or
no albums. They put out the first one was A Climb in the Walls, and that actually hit number 190 on the Billboard album charts. Believe it or not,
bubbling
190,
under
190, right? And then they put out a second one in 91 called 3D, which failed.
What year?
91.
91.
Yeah,
okay.
89 was their first record. And they got signed to Atlantic, two record deal. Ship got them signed.
Wrathchild America at that point, right?
Wrathchild America, yeah. They had just changed the name. So then once they were able to do that, then they could market. So and
they did a cover of Time by Pink Floyd, did they
on
not?
Their first album, and it's
It's great.
Fucking fantastic.
My friend in Quincy, Illinois had that frickin' record.
It's a great record. You know what? If you like thrash, it's great. It's a great record.
Was it Troy Meyer? I forget who had that. Oh, that was great.
Right? Yeah. I mean, that whole record's good. It's a fun record. So, 92, they changed their name again to Souls at Zero.
Yep,
and they released two LPs and an EP. They did nothing, and then they broke up, and that's when Shannon, he went to Santa Barbara and joined Ugly Kid Joe, and that's where his career really started to blossom. And, of course, now if you recognize the name, he's the drummer from fucking Godsmack now. So
Fucking Godsmack.
Little Kid did, you know, the little local guy did good, man, you know? Yeah. He's one of those kids you always root for. He's a good dude. He's, you know,
he's a great guy. Yeah. Super cool guy.
Right. I'm going to play something off. This is the L'Amour Rocks album.
What's this album worth? Look this up on Discogs. I bet this is worth a fortune. Is this Halloween on here?
Yeah.
Halloween's on here before they were signed?
Yeah, these were all bands that played at L'Amour's before they were signed.
Let's find out. Well, everybody think about what it's worth, and we'll look it up, see if we can find it.
All right, this is on Mercenary Records, and it came out in 1987. So we're going to play Armed to Deliver.
Well, they were throwing down.
Throwing the fuck down.
Getting on down.
Yeah, they were. And back up again. That was the Wrathchild America. Wrathchild America. But they were actually called Wrathchild then. They were not called Wrathchild America when they sent L'Amour this single.
And so I do have the results of the value of that record if you're interested.
Oh.
I found it while we were listening.
$1.99.
Would you like to place your bets? Place your bets. Liz, how much do you think it's worth?
$14.99.
All right. AD, what do you think that record is worth?
$2.50.
$2.50. Wow, you guys are very far apart there. Actually, it is L'Amour, which is L...
L'Amour. L...
There's no apostrophe. There's no apostrophe if you're searching for it, I noticed. That's why it took me a while to find it, but there's no apostrophe. So L'Amour, L-A-M-O-U-R, rocks is what you search for.
$9. $9.
All right.
Get it delivered to your house for...
$9.
I didn't do shipping.
Well, I got to thank G-Man for that one, because G-Man bought me that.
G-Man found it?
Yeah,
oh, right on.
Cool. For my birthday, he took me out, and he goes, let's go to the record store. So I saw that, and I'm like, what is that? What?
That's great. There's Halloween's on there. There's all kinds of cool local bands. I love that stuff.
It's a great raw record. It's just, you know, local bands, you know, the kind of, again, upper echelon of the metal bands that are doing the A Club circuit.
Right before you made it.
And it's freaking metal. There's a lot of the songs you go, I just heard this one. And then the next one come on, you go, I just heard that one again.
A lot of dooga deca dooga deca.
Yeah, a lot of that. And you know, the riffy stuff that, you know.
Cool. Well, are we cool to move on?
Let's rock.
Well, that just plays right into my hand, AD. I have a record from March of 1979 that, as I listen to it a couple times today, I go, I think this is it. This is the most rocking album I have in my collection. Like, there's no album that rocks relentlessly like this album in my collection. I mean,
well, then here, you can have this one.
L'Amour rocks. Yeah. No, I'm fine. Because this one's, I mean, I haven't heard that record, but I can tell you unequivocally that this is way better.
Yeah, probably.
I'm speaking of Overkill by Motorhead.
What?
Look at that beauty.
I
just reordered one of the reissues here, or ordered one of the reissues.
What a great album cover.
Look at
ever.
That cover. This album is just grabs you by your throat and doesn't let you go for about 38 minutes straight.
Oh.
And read some of the song titles, AD. What you got on there?
Well, we have Overkill. We have Stay Clean.
Yeah.
I won't pay your price.
Yeah.
I'll be your sister.
Another good one.
Capricorn. No Class.
No Class.
Damage Case.
Damage Case. I'm playing that one.
Tear you down.
Tear you down.
Smoking a cigarette. Metropolis. And Limb from Limb.
Limb from Limb. Another good one. So a classic, and really where you start to see the Motorhead formula develop, AD, where every chorus, all you do is say the title of the song three times or four times.
And they go, oh yeah, the last time.
Yes. How does Overkill's chorus go?
Overkill, Overkill, Overkill.
How about
right.
How about No Class?
No Class, No Class, No Class. Yeah.
How about Capricorn?
Stay Clean.
Stay Clean, go.
Stay Clean.
Stay Clean. All right, that's all right. All right. How about Capricorn?
Capricorn.
Capricorn.
Yeah.
So great. Oh, this album is my favorite Motorhead record. A lot of people say Ace of Spades is where you go, but not me, AD.
Really?
I go to Overkill.
Ooh.
Overkill's way better.
Highly debatable, though. That fucking Ace of Spades is Ace of Spades, man.
Yeah, I know. How's that chorus go for Ace of Spades?
Ace of Spades.
So we've been talking a lot about Motorhead because of I played I'm a Police Car a couple weeks ago by a guy called Larry Wallace, who was the original guitarist in Motorhead. And so what happens is they recorded that record called On Parole, if I'm not mistaken, is the title of their first record. So this is technically Motorhead's second record, although as far as the public is concerned, it's their first full-length album. It was this On Parole was released after this album hit big. And so Bronze Records signed Motorhead in 1978, and gave them time in Wessex Studio in London to record a song. Now, this is after the On Parole record was recorded and it shelved because everybody's like, what the hell is this? I'm not putting this out. Larry Wallace, Lemmy, and Filthy Phil on the drums. And so Bronze apparently knew enough, or somehow they got signed to, they signed Motorhead, and they put him in the studio to record a cover of Louie Louie on a 45. And the owner of Bronze Records, who is, I think it's Terry, somebody Braun is his last name. He says, quote, "The first time I heard Motorhead was when I listened to a single that I put out without hearing, which is Louie Louie. And when I heard it, I was absolutely horrified. I thought it was the worst record I've ever heard." So it was a bit of a shock. "The bigger shock was having put out a record that I thought was terrible. It went straight into the charts at number 72, but I actually put the record out as a favor to somebody." So wow. I guess the whole signing was like a favor. For whatever reason, Louie Louie gets a little traction. Sales of the single brought the band their first appearance on BBC's Top of the Pops. And there's Motorhead on Top of the Pops.
Wow.
Based on Louie Louie.
Have you seen that?
Yeah.
It's pretty interesting.
It's something.
Yeah.
It's weird. Go YouTube that, Motorhead Louie Louie on Top of the Pops. And of course, man, if you're in England and you're on Top of the Pops, Bronze is going, "You're making a full length album tomorrow, right now. All right, get in there. Gonna, you know, gave them, you know, go ahead and make the record. Here's the money, make a full record. And the rest is history. You know, this album comes out and it's just, timing is everything in this business, as we've learned time and time again. 1979, this album drops. You're right in the middle of the things that are happening in England with Iron Maiden, with the new wave of British heavy metal and all that stuff. All of that stuff is converging at the same time. And here comes a record, which is a masterpiece of what it is. I mean, it's punk and metal put together. It's like you take these guys, give them guitars, methamphetamines, and whiskey, and go play as loud as you can.
It was the same. It was sort of the same effect that the Ramones had. In that sense.
Yeah.
Like blistering, fast, relentless beats, just, you know, and over the top, almost monotone lyrics.
Right.
Melodies, I'm sorry, you know, like monotone, you know, you know, there's not much melody going on.
Not really.
It's phrasing, vocal phrasing. And
right.
Note-ish.
What is the quality here that's attractive? Why do people love Motorhead?
Why do people love the Ramones?
The Ramones were a pop band, dressed in a punk overlay, but like Motorhead,
Motorhead's not much different.
It's not a pop
really.
Band at all.
Well, like, they're simple songs. They're three chord songs and they're
riffy.
Repetitive choruses and right.
No,
I mean,
doubt
it's,
about
it's
that.
Really formulaic in the exact same way.
Yeah, yeah, certainly.
When you think about that, so it's simple. And again, the raw aggression, there's some band. How many times have you seen people like a song is rocking and then the band sort of stops rocking and then dude goes, oh, fuck, you know, the guy listening to it. Like, it just, because it's nonstop, it's music for people who just want it, that high speed.
Yeah.
It's almost a thrill ride, if you will.
Totally.
And a sonic thrill ride.
There's a moment on this record I noticed today when I'm listening to it. The title track, Overkill, side one, track one. Duka taka duka taka duka taka duka taka.
Overkill.
Filthy Phil, who I want to talk about. They do all those false endings in that song, even on the record. Not the live version. I'm talking like on record. Like they stop the song and trash can end it, but then... it does it three times. There's
That's
a moment
what I'm talking
on the,
about
on the third time. It's like it's ending. You're like a third time, and you just hear the drums, and you just hear this bass going coming. It was like reaching through the speaker and grabbing you by the throat. You're just like, this is a relentless freaking record.
That is the thing. That's like a magnet.
Oh, it's very attractive. Yeah.
I mean, the first time you heard it, you just go, the song's not over, and they go back into it. Fuck yeah.
Right.
I mean,
it's incredible.
Immediately you go, there's that.
There are moments of not necessarily redlining the entire, like Overkill, of course, is a redlined song, but like just pinned. Everything is pinned. The tachometer is pinned in Motorhead's camp. But the, like, it goes right into Stay Clean, right? Which has the greatest groove. Boom, ba-doom, ba, da-oom, ba-doom, ba. And the pocket is so big, man. You could put all of my money and all of your money and both of our phones.
You would need a very big pocket for.
You know, you put everything in there. And that's Filthy Phil Animal Taylor on the drums, of course. And I wanted to kind of speak to him because we always talk about Lemmy, and of course he's the benevolent dictator of Motorhead, but it's Phil, you know, the drummer who has a great groove, right?
Everybody loves him.
Everybody loves him. He's crazy as a loon.
Yeah.
So when Lemmy first met Phil in the summer of 75, this goes back a ways, he never imagined that this stoner would wind up in his new band, right? So he says, quote, I was with Hell's Angels at the time, and he used to come and score dope at our house. Then he'd light up and pass out, and we'd wake him up in the morning and send him home. He was always telling us he was a drummer, but we never took him seriously. But when the drummer that Lemmy originally hired to do that first album didn't really gel with the band, Lemmy reached out to that stoner dude that was passing out on the floor at the...
Hey, wake up. I've got a gig for you. And a joint. And you snort this.
And Lemmy said, quote, Phil said, sure, I'll fucking come down and do it for you. We overdubbed him on our first album except for one track. He proved to be the maniac we needed. And you know, there's all the stories of Phil, you know, like breaking his hands and literally taping drumsticks. Like, there's a cast and a drumstick sticking out of it so he can do the gig. And just all these things, like, one after the next, you know. And, if you've never seen it, that classic album's Ace of Spades is so great.
Oh, God, come on, right?
It's the three of them getting back together, and they kind of jam a bit, you know. It's, of course, Fast Eddie Clark and Filthy Phil and Lemmy together talking about Ace of Spades and all the stories. Fast Eddie Clark talking about there's a fight in the front row and during one of the Motorhead gigs, and he jumps off the stage and gets into the fight because it was some security guy had punched a girl or something. And he's talking about, like, and I've launched myself off of the stage.
Oh, set him right.
It's so great. I just love these guys. And they're timeless. It's a band that never went out of style, right? I mean, I can't remember a time when Motorhead wasn't cool.
Right.
Right. You know? All right, let's do this. Damage right. Case, side two, track two, AD, Overkill.
Damage case.
Ah, there they go.
Come on.
They never fell out of favor. They were never out of style. We were just talking about that, like, so similar to the Ramones in that even they were never huge. But when you thought about the Ramones, you know, when you thought about Motorhead in what, 90s, you know, early 90s or whatever, you go, they never fell into the where are they now file.
Yeah.
Well, I tell you where they are. They're on the road somewhere. Yep. They're playing. They're playing a gig somewhere.
And you can't go far without seeing a Motorhead t-shirt or a Ramones t-shirt anyway. Right. So it's yeah, they were always on the road. They were always working. Everybody was confused as how is this good? But the people who loved them look at you and go, how, you just don't get it.
You were so off base.
Right? Yeah.
I've loved them since I was like 13.
Well, so. It's simple and it's repetitive. And so it's easy. Easy to remember. It's easy to get into. It's hooky. The words aren't complex.
No.
Complex. 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 Complex.
All right, Edie, what you got?
All right. Well, I got some.
Steve Marriott.
Last time we checked in with the hero of this story, he was trying to reconcile with his old bandmates, score a new record deal. None of those went too well. His old bandmates were not interested, nor were the labels. Our hero is the incomparable Steve Marriott of Humble Pie.
What the fuck? You found a solo album?
I didn't know he made his very first solo album, Ryan.
Look how hard he's rocking on the cover.
Thank you, G-Man, again for another awesome birthday present. This record.
Oh, you like Steve Marriott.
Oh,
you're attracted to Steve Marriott.
That voice, huh? He whispered in your Liz, all right. I want you to bend over.
Oh, come on. Oh, that's offensive. Mark's going to come.
Not this way, but that way. No, not this way, but that way. So, I brought his first solo album. It's called Marriott.
What year is this?
2018, Ryan.
Damn it. two times in one show.
1976.
70.
So, 76. 76, yeah. This album was produced by Kerner and Wise.
Does it sound better than Hotter Than Hell?
It does. Okay. It's a good record. Now, here's the deal with this record. So the Pie had just split up.
the Pie.
We can't call him the Pie.
No, the Pie.
That will not go into the shabby lexicon.
Humble Pie, you know, we all know their story. We love them. And you know what? And they were still putting out good records, I thought, till the end. A couple of the members in the band thought otherwise. I believe Greg Ridley believed their last record was shite or something similar, but
oh, really?
It's a whole different thing. I thought they started getting the more soulful thing going on. I thought their last couple records were still pretty good.
On to Victory.
That was a good. I played a song from that record.
Yeah, recently played. Yeah,
consistent record. It's a Humble Pie record. A little more soulful. A little less, early 70s. You know, a little less. What do you call it? Fillmore ish. But nonetheless, a valid, great, soulful, bluesy rock album from England. Oh, jeez.
Oh, here we go again.
Yeah. All right. So I'm gonna pick another record. I'm going to play the Susie Quattro record while I tucky. So what happened was, there were copious amounts of cocaine and booze, and he was smoking a lot of weed and drinking a lot.
Jesus.
And yeah. And
quite a cocktail.
Oh, did I leave out amphetamines?
Oh,
I forgot amphetamines. Yeah,
okay.
Whatever was
in his reach.
Pretty much everything. So, but by all accounts, he had developed a pretty bad case of actual, diagnosed schizophrenia. So, and his wife quoted at the time, she was like, that he was just about to go on tour. And this is a quote. He says, please tell me you'll leave me if I go on tour again, because if you say that, then I'll have justification not to go. And if I go, then I'll have to be that person again, and I'll go mad.
Oh.
Sort of that. He's
wow. Not sure if that qualifies as schizophrenia, but just sounds like a guy that's like, I have no other choices but to go do what I do for a living. And it's killing me because it's the temptations of doing drugs and all that is out there when you're on the road. When you're playing Louisville, Kentucky on a Wednesday night.
Well, that prompted him.
Sorry, Louisville.
Yeah, right. Louisville. Louisville.
Louisville.
Louisville.
Louisville. Louisville. Okay. Again, sorry, Louisville.
But by then now, he had built his own studio at their house, the Beehive Cottage. And he would go into the studio, according to his wife, and she wouldn't see him for days. It's in their house.
Days. Not going in for a cup of tea?
No, and she said all kinds of strange people were coming and going, and this was getting on now, so she finally left him. He was a wreck. Humble Pie was falling apart.
This is in 76?
Approaching 76. This record came out in 76. You know, kind of leading up to it, their last couple of records, this is sort of an ongoing thing as it was building and becoming more noticeable.
Okay.
They said his personality had completely changed. It had gone, 180, that he was completely consumed with his phobias and his fears and his substances and everything else. So they struggled on, and early 75, he's just like, I can't do this anymore. But drugs weren't the only issue.
Okay.
There was money. And the mob.
And the lack thereof. And the mob. Holy shit. Uh-oh.
In a 2000 interview with Humble Pie drummer Jerry Shirley, Shirley states that we'd lost sight of our business arrangements and no one within the band had any control over the money matters. But the main reason was that we were making bad records. It all came to a head in early 75. The rot had set in so deep, it was inevitable. So he wasn't happy with the records. I thought they were fine. I'm a Humble Pie fan. I thought they were good.
That's Thunderbox, which is a great record.
Great record, right? Yeah.
Huh.
But, apparently, and maybe the bad records just meant they weren't selling. That's kind of an ambiguous statement.
What they were doing was not selling.
Right. So, of course, the label's going, yeah, you're making bad records.
We need a hit, we start to believe it.
And don't forget now, around 75, what was happening with a little kid named Peter Frampton who used to play in Humble Pie. Right.
Ouch.
His record was huge, okay? So here's the deal. A guy named D. Anthony was Humble Pie's business manager. And he had begun to involve himself with the Peter Frampton thing, especially getting money to finance and put out and just really exploit the Frampton Comes Alive album. So those in the Humble Pie camp all knew that Anthony was siphoning money to finance Frampton's record.
What?
They called him out on it.
Humble Pie money financing Frampton Comes Alive.
You bet your ass.
Wow.
He was working for Humble Pie and secretly working for Frampton at the same time. Now, according to Marriott's second wife, he didn't do so well on the first one. During the making of this album, the one you have, Marriott, they were warned about making accusations regarding D. Anthony's handling of their money. They were like, they would get threatening phone calls and like, you can't do this. Now, they were living in New York at the time.
Or what?
And had a place. Well, Marriott ignored those warnings and went to the press and was really making a big stink about it. So he and his wife were summoned to a meeting about the missing money in Little Italy in New York City at a restaurant. Seated at the table waiting for the Marriotts to arrive were John Gotti, Frank LoCascio, and Paul Castellano of the Genovese crime family.
Okay.
It was suggested to Mr. Marriott that he just ignore the money and drop the matter.
Holy shit.
Steve Marriott dropped the matter.
Yeah. Good move, Steve Marriott. Yeah.
Right? So.
Ooh, wow.
That's
so
the,
then that draws a very interesting points a finger at that Peter Frampton album as being sort of mobby.
Well,
because that record was everywhere. And it's a great record.
I'll tell you a story during when the record's playing about that.
You know something.
I know, yes, a lot about it.
Oh.
I have firsthand experience with it. So
you're teasing the audience, and you're never gonna pay it off.
This could get me killed, Ryan.
Oh well, but by all means, do tell.
Do it on air, please.
Please.
I'll write it down. You tell it, and you have to say I instead of AD. Okay. Now this is an interesting record because there's no side A or side B. If you notice, pull the album out of the inner sleeve.
Yes, I did notice that on the cover. It should be noted that he's just rocking with a guitar, but he's in front of. Take it easy, Liz. On either side is sort of a
A British flag
and an American Union Jack and Old Glory.
Right. So if you look at the actual vinyl.
Oh, is the vinyl the same?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's a British side. British side and American side.
Okay, now what happened was Steve Marriott on, well, there's no one or two, but on the British side used a bunch of British players, and including Greg Ridley on bass.
His Humble Pie
his
bass player.
Mate, yeah, you know, from Humble Pie. And a bunch of other, you know, pretty shit-hot British players at the time.
Anyone we know or
nah,
we can
you know, a couple like Ian, I think Ian Wallace was on it.
The Ian Trevor, Crim- was Trevor in
it? Well, Ian, it's interesting. Well, you got Greg Ridley on bass, right? You got Ian Wallace, right, on drums, who played with King Crimson.
Okay.
Guess what the first time I ever got high was a King Crimson Humble Pie concert.
Yeah. Oh, well,
that's kind of cool, right?
That's
awesome, right?
Excellent.
Yeah. And Mickey Waller from the Heavy Metal Kids was the guitar player on this record. Okay. On the British side. On the British side.
Okay.
Now, so the American side was made in L.A., with L.A. Session Cats. Now, here's the thing.
Blackie Lawless.
No, dude, check this out, though, you guys.
Chris Holmes.
The British side.
CeCe DeVille.
Right, yeah. And
Bobby Dahl.
And Hal Blaine on drums.
Hal Blaine. Glenn Campbell. It was an odd session.
Carol Kay.
Carol Kay was on bass.
And Phil Spector on gun. So, but the contrast in this record is so stark, and I think I got to call Steve Marriott out on this one, because the British side of this record is one of the best Humble Pie albums you've ever heard.
But Jerry Shirley's not playing on it.
Hey, that guy, fucking
the drummer.
Dude, Ian Wallace is killing it.
Okay.
You'll hear. But the American side, it is so... It's 76, disco sneaking up on
you. Oh, here we go.
So there's elements of big disco production, like slick kind of that production almost glittery, glitzy production over it. And it's, I don't want to say it's horrible, but it's not that good.
Oh, no.
It's a great outside. The British side, buy this album for that side. I'm telling you, you do want to
I've
have
never
it.
Seen this album. I didn't know it existed.
But the American side, dude, it's just so... I don't know.
Contrived?
And the thing is, my gripe with it is this. Okay, Steve, you're living in New York. If you're going to make an American side, you know, do your record with New York guys. You're in Humble Pie. You're not in fucking Eagles, you know?
I think it's just called the Eagles, but
whatever they are, yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, would you please welcome the fucking Eagles? Ding, 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 ding. That's the beginning of that damn song. On a dark desert highway, that one. Ladies and gentlemen, yeah. Damn.
Burning air, white line eyes.
Ladies and gentlemen, would you please fucking Eagles? Across town, she's getting laid, or whatever that song is. You can't hide your
thunder thighs.
So I'm going to play side one, track one. Might as well start there, right? See what he's into. This is called East Side Strutting.
Oh, cool.
Strutter? Yeah. It sounds like strutter.
All right.
I love Humble Pie.
We should have an all right off between Steve and Marriott.
All right.
All right. All right. All right.
Don't go.
well, how about that?
It's very pie-y.
It's very pie-ish. Pious.
Pious.
Pious. Yeah. Pious.
Pious. Pious.
I don't know. It feels a little like he's going through the motions there.
Well, he's tired. He's addicted.
He's on a lot of drugs.
He's broke. His wife hates him. His manager is fucking him. You know, the mob is going.
His manager is fucking him?
Well,
wow. Oh, that is really difficult.
Listen, I would take a good fucking rather than a good showbiz fucking any day of the week.
If you could maybe talk about the differences between the two.
Yeah, right? I'm going to fuck you. Then I'm going to fuck you.
I'm going to fuck you and showbiz.
And I'm going to showbiz fuck you.
All right. Well, hey, let's thank Liz Morgan for running the controls over there.
Hey,
great
Liz
job.
Morgan.
I am so, I have to grovel before her sidekick.
I'm going to step away from the microphone. While
please
you
give me a moment to grovel before our dear friend, and who I really shunned. I was just moving things along. I'm really sorry. Sal 5000.
Stop tormenting me.
I'm not tormenting you. I just, you know, I don't want to see your... It's difficult for me because you're a computer, and I have no idea how to talk to you, and I'm terrible.
You're not going
to
get off that easily.
I know. It's just that you know, we kind of ran through the top of the show probably a little too fast, but I apologize. I mean, sincerely.
You know, I live to serve you.
Oh, thank you.
How's it going in there, right?
You're back?
How's it going for you guys?
I think we patched things up,
right?
But I'm not really sure.
Sal. How's she doing? How you doing, Sal? You all right? You guys?
All this power surging and throbbing, yet under control.
Right. Aww.
See?
Yeah. Love is the answer.
It's her way. Love is the answer. Todd Rundgren. All right. Well, hey, D. Before I say the thing I always say, I want to thank you guys very much for tuning in to the Shabby Road Record Show. 173 episodes in the books, and you guys sharing stuff on Facebook and on Twitter at Shabby Podcast. All the things you guys do. It's just going great, but we really appreciate it. And the Shabby Forum over on the ShabbyRoadRecordShow.com page, where there's an Amazon banner, and you can help fund the show, because it costs money to you know, post these shows week after week. And we would appreciate it if you're buying a Steve Marriott record or a Todd Rundgren Utopia record on Amazon, you go to our site first, just click through. It doesn't cost you a penny. All that stuff, you know, you guys know the drill by now. But we appreciate you guys hanging out with us here at the Sham and AD. Well, the mystery boxes are empty.
Oh, they are as empty as Beyonce's box while Jay-Z is on tour. So I do believe it's time.
I got to go first.
Oh, I thought you were throwing it.
No, I have one too.
Okay, good go.
Well, the mystery box. It's not any better than yours. One of my films, yeah. So, the mystery boxes are empty, so I'm going to make a break for it, AD, before the hookers and tweakers breach the doors and windows here at the Shab, Night of the Living Dead style, you know? Before I go, I'll hand a shotgun to our last hope for survival, AD Adams. Okay, that sucks. Okay.
We're all going to die. Oh, God.
You ready?
Yeah. Well, indeed. Our boxes are as empty as Beyonce's while Jay-Z is on tour. So I do believe it is time we threw ourselves out of this crap hole, bouncers, and onto the dark and dank streets of Sunny Slope. So please be careful. Those bum hurl puddles are a lot deeper than they look. And now, with all those pleasantries out of the way, I'd like to wish my partner, pal, and co-host, Ryan McKay, a splendid evening, a hearty cheerio, and just to brush up again on my lingo espanol, a boner's nachos. Good night,
that doesn't
everybody.
Mean anything. Oh no, boner's nachos.
A portion of the Shabby Road Record Show is fearlessly brought to you by those crazy bastards at nameonanything.com. Use the promo code Shabby at checkout and save 10% on your order. Nameonanything.com.
How would Steve Marriott check us in at the hotel? Hey, I'm here. Rooms are under prima.
Well, I like to tell you, the room's going to be ready in about 15 minutes or so.
Listen, we are coming off a long flight. Is there any way we can get in early, like right now? I don't want to sit in the lobby. I just really want to get in here.
All right. I got you covered.
Oh, thanks, Steve, man. That's so great. I'm so glad you're working at the Marriott.